Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.
We're glad you found us. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with your host, Reverend Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from College Station, Texas. I'm down here with my latest grandchild and having a wonderful time. It's a warm and balmy late May day in South Central Texas. And today I'm joined by Texas Christian University professors, and they've been on the show many times before, Mark Dennis and Andy Fort. Dr. Andy Fort is actually a professor emeritus after serving in the religion department for several decades, can you believe? He now spends his time with family, traveling throughout the world, and on academic projects and experiential spirituality, including the topic we're talking about today, which is contemplative studies. Dr. Mark Dennis is a professor in the religion department, a part of the Adran College of Liberal Arts, again at TCU. And his focus is on Asian religions, religion and violence, free speech, and religion and contemplative studies. And so it's a joy to welcome Andy and Mark back to the show. Welcome. Glad you're here.
Thanks. And Mark is now a full professor, recently promoted.
That is awesome, isn't it? Full tenure, everything. All right. Excellent.
Thanks for having us back, Paul. Yeah. It's great to be back with you.
Of course, yeah. You know, I was reading a piece on a recent conference that was led by Franciscan friar, author, and founder of the Center for Action and Contemplation, Father Richard Rohr, and quite a few of the photographs that I saw in accompanying that article were of millennials or even people younger than that. And each was drawn, it seems, to the variety of approaches that contemplative studies provides, right? Be it, you know, centering prayer or Lectio Divina, body-based approaches, modalities, kirtan, you know, chanting, yoga, other means. So it's fascinating to me. It was called spiritual but not religious, right? People were interested in the spirituality, not necessarily in the religious dogma or the organization of religion. Now I think the latest term is nuns, right? They don't have any affiliation, but they're still spiritual. So is that what you're finding in – and I know it's growing, isn't it, in universities? You're going to tell us all about what's happening in TCU, but it's a field and what's exciting for me about it is it's very experiential. It's not intellectual. So let's throw that out. Yeah. You know, what are you finding?
Thanks for the softball, because one of the things I wanted to talk about, Mark and I just finished co-teaching a course. We're joined at the hip called A Contemplative Life. But what I wanted to start with, given where you started from, is a really interesting, excellent book that's just come out by a, younger, although she's in her 40s, to us that's younger, a scholar named Anne Gleig about contemporary or Buddhism in America. And we can generalize it from Buddhism toward the point you were making about a shift from us boomers who kind of, if you look at the demographic, largely upper middle class, white, et cetera, to younger people, millennials, who are much more diverse and looking to adapt and move from what you might call our boomer modernism to postmodernism. Anyway, the book's called American Dharma. I really recommend it. And I did want to suggest at some point in our conversation, I wanted to mention it because it's really been interesting for me to note kind of my age and background and how much that shaped us, and that includes you, in our day, and how now things are transforming. So let me start with that and then see what Mark wants to say, and maybe we can talk about what we found very directly with our students today.
Yeah, because there was that seminal book, wasn't there, by Rick Fields, you know, when the swans came to the lake, or whatever, about Buddhism in America, and it spoke to the baby boomer generation, like you're talking about. So sounds like this one is a sort of updated version. You know, where are we now? Because it's morphed substantially from the old way of looking at it.
Yeah, and Paul, I would add. I mean, you touched on this distinction of, you know, spiritual but not religious, and this is a conversation I often have with my students. And many of them still identify in that way, and that is a long conversation that we could have. But one of the things Andy and I discovered in co-teaching this course, one of the books we use is called Mindful America, and it's really focused on mindfulness, but talks a lot about how you know, the practices of mindfulness come out of Buddhism, but they have been appealing to people in all walks of life. You know, there's the military and business and sports and many others. And it's appealing to, you know, a variety of things that are going on in our society more broadly, but specifically with millennials and the generation that follows them, the iGen, especially those who've grown up, you know, kind of with smartphones and social media. And so there's a lot of really interesting developments going on in kind of contemplative practices more broadly that represent, you know, kind of the point you were making to start with about this article where there's all of these different kinds of practices. And it's not uncommon for people, especially younger people, to pick and choose what seems appropriate. And, you know, for those who would classify themselves as spiritual but not religious, one of the common motivations for that is some kind of dissatisfaction with, you know, institutionalized religion. And if there is that kind of, you know, a rejection of that, then it opens up the possibility of, you know, kind of picking and choosing, maybe doing a little yoga here, some mindfulness there, and maybe some other kinds of practices. One of the other things that Andy and I have dealt with a lot, and as part of our contemplative studies group, is Christian contemplative practices. You know, we're teaching at a Christian, at TCU, Texas Christian University. And so it's really been interesting for us to see how different students and also others who self-identify as Christians kind of navigate these, the contemplative practices that we have been teaching in classes or offering in, you know, in the contemplative studies group through meditation or presentations and things like that.
I'll say one more thing for now and then see what how you react. It was interesting to me because both Mark and I lean Buddhist, we checked in with the students in our class more than once about, is this coming across too religious or too with a particular religion? And none of them, I don't even know what religion any of the students are there. And they said, no, that's kind of interesting. We like to hear what you have to say in the background to it. So they're, in a way that I find refreshing, kind of detached from being aligned with any one thing or another.
Yeah, interesting. Well, of all the religions, though, probably Buddhism is the easiest to take on board, you know, because it's more like more spiritual psychology, isn't it, than it is a religion. I mean, it of course it does have religious aspects, but the way that Buddhism is taught and has been introduced to the West really is mindfulness practices or awareness practices or, you know, techniques that can be applied in, you know, in any situation, and that makes it sort of easy to take. You know, there's practices in, say, if you go into, you know, Ignatian spirituality and the practices of the Jesuits, whatever, you know, they're heavily focused on Jesus. They're heavily focused, at least in the beginning, on sin. So you know, it's hard then if you're not into sin and Jesus to take those on board, really. In the same way that you can maybe a mindfulness practice. You know, it's interesting at Unity School, you know, Unity headquarters, then the prayer ministry there, Silent Unity, which has been going now for over 125 years, you know, offers prayer via phone or online or letters, whatever, to anybody that calls in. They now have their own mindfulness and meditation technologies staff person, you know, who offers a lot of things. He works especially online. He's intent upon reaching the millennials, you know, and this speaks to the very thing we're talking about. You know, even a fairly old institution like Silent Unity, and that's a long time to do prayer work. You know, they're looking at new ways of reaching people, because, you know, some of the old ways, some of the old modalities that we use in Silent Unity are wonderful, but, you know, the average age of people who are using them is, you know, probably in their 60s now. So we understand, you know, we have to reach the younger generations, and they're not necessarily interested in, you know, reading a scripture with a nice affirmative passage or whatnot. They want something a little more edgy. Let's talk about that, because that's what it seems to me is the edgy aspect of it. Yeah, go ahead.
About apps, and then Mark can talk about some, what's the word, podcasts that he's very familiar with. With the apps, you know, you probably know there's Calm and Headspace and Insight Timer, and they all are worth millions of dollars, and they all have this huge smorgasbord of, and Buddhism or any particular religion's really downplayed, smorgasbord of exercises. And of course, millennials are far more app-oriented than some of us older folks. But, well, let Mark talk a little bit about the podcast.
Okay, well, I'm glad that you came up with the word smorgasbord, because I was waiting. How long into the show is it going to be before Andy brings up that word smorgasbord? I know it's one of your favorites. But I love that, because that's what we're talking about. You know, it's a smorgasbord of spiritual possibilities, right? And you don't eat everything. You take which, you know, you find the most appetizing for you. And what I like to think, too, is that sometimes in my life, you know, something is appetizing. Later on, I might get more involved in something else, right? That there's, depending on our level of interest and maturation, you know, there's you might want to take on Ignatian spirituality, you know, once you've matured yourself to see it, you know, in a deeper sense. But if you're stymied by some of its vocabulary, maybe it's a barrier. So that's another thing. It morphs, doesn't it? As we change, the offerings change.
Yep.
Yeah. No, that's certainly true, Paul. And just a quick comment to respond to what Andy had said before about the podcasts. We used a lot of podcasts in the class that we co-taught this last semester. And one, if we could just name one that's really good, is the 10% Happier podcast. And there's a book called 10% Happier that we used in class, and I've used in other classes, and students really like. It's by Dan Harris, who's an ABC News journalist.
Right,
very
yeah,
skeptical.
I've read it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and so he's a very good interviewer, and he has maybe more than 200 episodes now, and he has interviews with people ranging from, you know, the Dalai Lama and other Buddhist teachers coming out of Tibet and Zen and other traditions. But then he's got all kinds of other people, including Richard Davidson, who is a neuroscientist at the University of Wisconsin, founder and director of the Center for Healthy Minds, who will be coming to TCU next spring, and maybe we can come back to that. But that podcast is really quite good. And Paul, to get back to what you were saying, there is a kind of this diffusion of mindfulness, and there is a debate over this, and this debate is articulated in the book I mentioned called Mindful America, that these practices are coming out of Buddhist mental cultivation practices, and then they have been secularized as a way to make them, you know, accessible or palatable to people who aren't interested in studying Buddhism per se. And so Andy and I have talked a lot about this, and overall I think this is a positive development, but there's some legitimate criticisms of taking something out of its original religious context and then changing them or claiming authority over these kinds of practices without, you know, what we might consider to be proper training. And mindfulness in particular is interesting. You said you talked about the example at Unity, and it comes out of Buddhist context, but it's really just learning to pay attention and to be present. And for many, especially for millennials, that is very difficult. Everything in their lives is trying to draw them away from, you know, the present to either the past or the future. And so it's really an interesting development, what you mentioned with Unity.
Well, the interesting thing about, you know, taking things on board and changing them from their original intent, you know, it happens throughout history, doesn't it? You know, I was reading about, you know, Kabbalistic history recently, and that was the very same thing also. You know, it was a reaction against some two over-formulated rabbinic teachings. You know, they wanted to get back to something a little more visceral and mystical, and created a whole, you know, new way of looking at it, and you know, made it seem to come from an ancient tradition when it probably didn't. It was you know, the result of thinkers in Spain in you know, in the 13th century or whatever, but and yet, you know, it was also part of the tradition, so it did continue the lineage in a sense, but in a different format. So I'm actually okay with that, because I think, you know, what's worse is where you have a systematic teaching that can never change. You know, it becomes eventually ossified, doesn't it, because it's so rigid, you know. It has to, you know, that's where some of these Tibetan Buddhist, you know, immediate enlightenment paths come from, I think, is the idea that, yeah, you can study forever. You can, you know, be on this land rim, you know, step-by-step process. But eventually, you know, there's the breakthrough. Boom, you know, it happens immediately, you know. And so that's what we're talking about. I think people are wanting some kind of something they can do immediately. It may not be total transformation. The 10% may be enough, right? But it's a shift. It's a movement in a different direction.
Well, this is a really rich, complex topic because, yeah, it has to change or it will die. And yet, how do you keep the baby without the bathwater? Mm-hmm. One of the things, while I think of it, I wanted to go back to what Mark was saying. We've been talking about reaching millennials and younger students and the distraction level of contemporary culture. And one of the most interesting exercises that we did in this course was a digital awareness exercise in which we had the students check their digital devices when they woke up in the morning, and then they had to turn them off. And then at noon and 6, and before we allowed them to check in before bed, we had them journal and reflect on what was showing up both in their mind and their body when they couldn't use their digital devices. And it was sort of shocking to them. And the sort of most unforgettable student we had, she realized, and she used the going on digital devices broadly. It wasn't just looking at Facebook, but she was on 7 hours a day.
Wow.
And she cut back to 3. Yeah. But all of them found it a deeply revealing exercise, even for one day. And one of the things we discovered that we'll have to do if we do this again is to instruct them to tell their parents, closest friends, loved ones, the day before they go offline, because their close friends are going to panic when they can't be in touch with them.
You didn't respond immediately.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's true, isn't it? I remember going to India when I was in my 20s, you know, and there was the only way you could get in touch with someone was to write them a letter. And then, you know, that would take several days or a week or more to get back to them. And then it would be another couple of weeks to, you know, to receive an answer back. And that seemed like about the right time.
Very familiar,
you know,
with
2 weeks between them. Yeah, and now if you're not in touch, you know, in 5 seconds, there's something amiss. It's a great gift in a way, isn't it? That we wouldn't be doing this show unless we had that technology that allows for that. But, you know, it comes at a cost, and that is we're, you know, slaves to the machine, if you like.
Yeah,
there's a really interesting PBS NewsHour piece and then an article and a book by a demographer in the California system. I can't remember which, maybe UC Davis, but her name is Jean Twenge, T-W-E-N-G-E. And she talks about how the generation that has grown up with smartphones and especially social media, so Facebook, Instagram, et cetera, is on the cusp of a mental health crisis because they cannot live without these devices, and they take us away from kind of direct human to human interaction, which is crucial to mental health. And Andy and I have, you may remember, Paul John Dunn from the Center for Healthy Minds came down. He's been down to the campus a number of times, and he'll be back in the spring with Richard Davidson. But they have a course that they've developed called Student Flourishing, which is it has a lot of goals, but it's trying to help young people do well transitioning from high school to college. And one of the things that's part of this is these kinds of, you know, mindfulness and contemplative practices, and to develop a healthy relationship with, you know, their smartphones. Because Andy mentioned the one student, and she just, I mean, this is what she grew up with. She was swimming in this ocean and just, you know, just didn't know it. And for her, it was really eye-opening and, you know, very beneficial. She recognized that it was just consuming her life. And this is common for most of our students who, if you go out a, you know, in between classes, people are walking almost always with their, you know, their face buried in their cell phone, completely oblivious to what's going on around them.
Right, absolutely. Or even if you're in dinner with, you know, somebody and you see a table of young folks and they're all in their phones as well, you know, they it's like where does the when do they actually interact with a person that's face to face? I don't know if you're familiar, but there's a short story by E.M. Forster that called The Machine Stops, and it was written like over 100 years ago. It's very prescient. It's about exactly that. The machine stops. These people live in bunkers underground, and they communicate vast distances, you know, via, you know, modern communications. And but when the machine stops, everything, you know, they don't walk anymore. They can hardly walk. So the end of the story is this one of them, most of them die because they can't deal with not having the machine helping them. But one person, very brave person, climbs up. And he has to use his arms because his legs are atrophied, and climbs to the top and comes out, you know, in the bunker at the top of the city, and gazes out at the empty fields and beautiful scenery. It's the first time he's seen the light of day, and that's the end of the story. But it's very salutary, you know. It's if we become wholly dependent, you know, on the machine. And of course, if artificial intelligence begins to infiltrate, then, you know, we may become superfluous, right? I mean, it's a scary prospect.
Yeah. Though, I mean, we've been talking appropriately about millennials, but one of the things that we have found with people of all ages to actually move from knowing something's wrong and that we're too distracted and overstressed to actually doing practices, to doing self-care. This is this nut that we are all trying to crack. Mm-hmm. And I have two kids. One's a partner in a venture capital firm in Silicon Valley, and they talk about it all the time. And he's got a role model and a dad, but he says, oh, I just, I got to do it. And then it doesn't happen. Same with his friends. My daughter's a social worker, and she actually just did the MBSR, the Jon Kabat-Zinn, the mindfulness-based stress relief training. But she has a daughter. You're like, you have a granddaughter or grandchild. I'm not sure which gender. And how do you fit it in? So one of the things I think you and Mark and I are all on the same team with is trying to find places, interventions, if that's the word, where people will do for 10 minutes or whatever, do the self-care through contemplation.
Well, I think what's exciting too is when you do begin a practice, whatever it might be, you know, whether it's centering prayer or mindfulness or whatever, you see a result. There's something. Again, I like the. I'm not a smorgasbord man, but I'm a visceral man. I always have visceral coming up in my conversations. But there's something visceral about it, right? That you can't get from a machine, and I think that's exciting for anyone that really practices it. I'm big into looking. I think, you know, looking is a great form of practice too. It's a form of awareness, I guess, but just simply looking at things, you know, looking outside at trees and noticing the change, noticing the moods or whatever. After you do that for a while, it changes your body chemistry, you know, in such a way that you feel connected in a way that you can't with intellectual means or from machines. So, you know, I think that's maybe the hope here is that it's a feeling. I have to get to the feeling part of spirituality to make it work, right?
Yeah, agreed, Paul. And I think Andy's point is a good one. That
Hold that thought, okay. Mark. We're at the end of the segment. Join us in a couple of minutes after these messages. From Unity, folks, we'll be right back.
Experience the difference. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
Unity Online Radio is bringing the message of unity to thousands of spiritual seekers around the world. If you enjoy our programming, we invite you to support it by visiting unityonlineradio.org and clicking on Donate Now. Help us continue to provide inspiring content to everyone. Thank you for your support.
Here is a Unity Meditation Minute with Paulette Pipe.
So as always, we begin our time of meditation by first taking account of what we're feeling, those sights that we're seeing, those sensations that we're experiencing, and each breath that we breathe. Notice where in your body you're experiencing those sensations. Let your breathing find its own rhythm as we begin the process of letting go, the process of relaxation. Remember why we're here.
To hear more from Paulette Pipe and Touching the Stillness, visit the archives section at unityonlineradio.org.
For over 23 years, Liz Dawn and her team at Celebrate Your Life have been presenting transformative events with some of the world's leading spiritual teachers. Experience a Celebrate Your Life event for yourself, October 31st to November 4th in beautiful Sedona, Arizona. Explore your spirituality and open your mind to some new ideas. These events are awesome soul fests that heal and transform. Log on to celebrateyourlife.com to find out more.
Since 1924, Daily Word has offered inspiration and practical teachings through daily prayer messages to help people of all faiths live happy, healthy lives. The magazine includes 2 months of daily affirmations, messages, articles, and spiritual poetry to help you get inspired. Subscriptions are available for print editions in large type and Spanish, as well as the digital subscription package that includes the online magazine with audio, smartphone app, and daily email. Get your subscription today. Visit dailyword.com or unity.org.
More and more people are interested in a vegan lifestyle, and the numbers continue to grow. Join Victoria Moran every Wednesday at 2 p.m. Central for Main Street Vegan and learn how to make the shift to help animals and the planet. Each week, Victoria shares recipes, health tips, and interviews with celebrity vegans, experts, and activists. Learn how to make a difference for animals and the planet at every meal. Right here on Unity Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Call now with your question or comment. 816-251-3555. That's 816-251-3555.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Andy Fort and Mark Dennis. They're both professors at Texas Christian University, and we're talking about the subject of contemplative studies, and we've been waxing professorial in the first half, and it's been fun, but we're going to get a little more into the nitty-gritty in the second half. So I'm interested particularly in the practices that we might to do in terms of what are contemplative studies and some of the things that you offer at TCU in that regard. So if somebody's listening and they want to know, well, what are you talking about, contemplative studies? What can I practice today? What can I take on board? So let's talk about some of the examples.
Well, let me start by saying we actually have a website, and some of your listeners may know that the mascot of TCU is the horned frogs. So we like to riff with the frogs, and we have a website called contemplativefrogs.com. And on that site, we have some books we recommend, and we have an array of exercises we recommend. We also have some coming events. So that's something that your listeners might find useful.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, very good.
You start with exercise.
So give us a few examples of what might be on offer.
Sure, Paul. One of the exercises that we've used that's been very effective, our students have commented on this a lot, is simply a short breathing exercise. It generally goes by the number 4, 7, 8, and it's very simple to do. So you generally sit up straight in a comfortable position, close your eyes, and then inhale deeply as you're counting up to 4, and then you hold your breath for a count of 7, and then you exhale counting to 8. And you could do this 2 or 3 times. And you don't have to sit and close your eyes. You can do it while you're in traffic if you're experiencing road rage. And it's really effective. And a number of our students, 3 or 4 in particular, this last semester said they do this all the time. And that's a very good exercise simply to calm your mind down. And then one of the meditations that we use a lot is a counting meditation. It doesn't have any, you know, particular religious content, and it's to simply sit in a chair or, you know, on a cushion with your back straight and just count from 1 to 10, 1 with an inhalation, 2, exhale, 3, inhale, and then your mind will naturally wander, and when you realize you're no longer counting, you just start over. And this is a very simple meditation exercise that we use a lot. Students, not all students, some are not big fans of mathematics and numbers, but many of them like that. Another is a walking meditation. There's a lot of people who are uncomfortable sitting for extended periods of time. And so walking and simply paying attention, being mindful to what's outside, and this ties into some of the things you were talking about before, but especially if you can get out in a, you know, into a park or into nature, and just constantly bring your attention back to the environment. Andy and I took our students to the Botanic Gardens, to the, we have in the Fort Worth Botanic Gardens, there's a Zen garden. And so Andy had done this many times before and led them in kind of a series of meditation, you know, many of them moving meditations. And it was really, it's really quite powerful. And there's a lot of, Andy mentioned that we've got some books on our website. Those books have exercises. We have a list of exercises. And we're always happy to consult with people. They can contact us through the website, too.
Right,
and
very good.
Let me talk about a couple examples of different kind of exercise that some people might not immediately think is contemplative, but are. Anyway, one is a kind of mentor appreciation exercise in which we have people think about whether it's a parent, a teacher, a coach, a minister, or something, who had a really powerful influence on them, to think about that for a second, to actually write down a couple sentences about that, about exactly what was it about them, and then end with a kind of friendly challenge to actually call or email or text that person and express gratitude to them.
Mm-hmm.
So the internal reflection is to think about, who were your mentors? And what did they give to you? And then to actually reestablish the relationship in a deep sense of appreciation. And then the other is something that I've learned more from Mark, so I'll start and then he can say some more about it, is actually to have a circle of appreciation in which people do the sort of deep listening to others. And maybe they've been together like in a class or with a group that maybe you've led, that at a certain point gather people in a circle and everybody acknowledges someone. So I'll let Mark say a little more about that.
Yeah, so Paul, for our class, we always sat in a circle and Andy or I would introduce a topic. And we had a little ritual with us passing a stone and doing some bowing, which is quite nice. But then the semester culminated in something I've been doing for quite some time, which is this circle of gratitude or circle of appreciation. And as you know, we live in, I mean, if you look at the political climate, there's just a lot of anger and divisiveness. And so there's a lot of power to affirming the good things, the value that you see in others. And I've had quite a few students who have mentioned in kind of reflecting on the course how powerful this experience was, because they didn't see that other people recognized these kinds of qualities in them. And I think it's especially true because in among young people, among millennials, there's a lot of negative self-talk. And so this is really a useful exercise, and it ties in nicely to something that Andy often leads with his mellifluous voice, which is the metta or loving kindness meditation, which is, you know, you start and you wish yourself well, and then you kind of expand it. You think of somebody who you love deeply, and then somebody who you're neutral about, and then somebody who really irritates you. But one of the key elements of that metta or loving kindness meditation is expressing a gratitude. And Dan Harris, who wrote 10% Happier, goes through this, and the first time he does it, he thinks, oh, this is really stupid and hokey, and by the end of it, he's lying on the floor crying, blubbering like a child. And Andy and I have done it a bunch of times. We did a loving-kindness meditation for TCU DACA students a couple years ago, and it's really quite powerful.
What's beautiful about all this for me is, you know, it's a real world practice, right? You're talking about offering it for, you know, students or, you know, people in the university situation. And so it's no longer sort of a nice idea that we have in our own special meditation time. You know, it's something we bring into our everyday world, and that's exciting for me. I think it's exciting for everybody when they can see it's a way of life, right? It's a practice that is immediate for my conditions in my life right now. I think in so many ways, you know, religion is a sort of a Sunday observance, and then you have to find your way back into the real world, which isn't a very happy place. But this is taking it, you know, right down into that very place. I first came across that 4-7-8 breathing exercise in Andrew Weil's book, one of his health books, and I agree, it's amazingly powerful. And simple technique, you know, for total calming yourself. And I think the key is in holding the breath there for 7 seconds, you know, before you breathe out long. It just calms you right down. It completely changes your body and therefore your mind. I particularly like spiritual reading, you know, and what we mean by that is you take a passage, right, and you find a sentence or a phrase or even a word in there that particularly pops out at you, and then you sort of contemplate that and you meditate upon it, and you see it in a different way than maybe if you just read it intellectually. And when we were in Norway, I found an icon of the raising of Lazarus, and we took a photo of it and then made a copy of it, and I've been on my desk for a while, so I've been contemplating this icon of Lazarus and reading the passage from John 11. Well, at the end, it says, Jesus says, loose him and let him go. And last week, I think it was, or a few weeks ago, I had this huge breakthrough moment that it wasn't just about raising Lazarus here. This was an affirmation for release of myself, release my ego, loose him, let him go. You know, I don't have to hold on so tightly. Or if I've got enmity with someone, resentment, loose him, let him go. It's I want to be free. I don't want to hold on to the false constructs I've created about myself or others, you know. And so I've been using that affirmation in that way. And it's amazing because, you know, it takes it from a story in the Bible thousands of years ago to something very, very practical in my life today, because there's always someone that needs to be loosed, and most important, you know, my own humanness, you know, needs to be loosed so that it can go back to what it's supposed to be doing rather than taking center place in everything that I am. So, you know, that's a powerful technique for me, and you could do it with any book, right? It doesn't have to be the Bible. It could be any spiritual book that is imbued with that power that comes from sacred texts.
Yep, or all you need is love.
Let
me mention a couple things. One is, since you mentioned Andrew Weil, and that is where it comes from, just for your listeners, just, you know, go to Google in Andrew Weil. He's got a superb website that covers lots of different areas of well-being and more than one kind of breathing exercise. So there was something else I wanted to say, and now I forgot.
There's a lot of richness here, isn't there? There's a lot of tools and techniques, yes, readily available, and I'm glad that you're sharing some contacts here so people can look them up if they're interested.
And Paul, if I could just add, one of the issues that Andy and I are, one of our frustrations with students has been, without exception, they have done these mindfulness and meditation practices over the course of the semester and have realized, we ask them to write weekly reflections and have found great benefit with, you know, anxiety, depression, sleeplessness, you know, all kinds of things. And then when it's no longer assigned, then they often, even though they know it's good for them, they stop doing it. And so that's a frustration. One of the this next point is very different, but one of the things that's happened with contemplative practices, especially like yoga, mindfulness, is there's been a lot of hype, and it is a way for some people to make money. And so we have some friends and colleagues who have done some research that has also tried to pump the brakes a little and show that, you know, certain practices, especially really intensive ones, can harm people. And so, you know, the kinds of things that we do, so 10 minutes of meditation per day, we've been doing this with students for a long time, and really they've seen a lot of benefit. But there, you know, there are many different kinds of meditation practices. Some will resonate better with different kinds of, you know, personalities, but there's also some that are very intensive. And so, you know, it's important. It's like, you know, if you just start running or start jogging and then you run a marathon, you know, a week later, you're going to have problems. And so we have two friends at Brown University, Willoughby Britton and Jared Lindahl, who have, you know, if your listeners are interested, they have done a lot of different, they produce a lot of different kinds of material that's trying to show, well, overall, these are good practices, but it's also important to be, you know, careful and prudent when engaging in them.
Well, and as you say, commodification sets in. You know, it's a good idea, so let's make some money out of it. And before you know it, it's not quite the same, is it? It's a different case. It's tainted in a sense. But I think this happens, and the same with the gurus in the 60s. You know, a lot of them were sex addicts for one reason or another, and you know, and so that sort of tainted it. You know, we were all naive, and then we grew up. So again, it all points to the idea that, you know, there is no magic cure, right? There's only what feels right for you. And I think it's important in any of these practices that we trust our intuitive awareness, right? That you know, not believe somebody because they have the latest greatest thing and it's gonna, you know, save your life or it's gonna enlighten you, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we're already enlightened, aren't we? We already have the Christ within us. The Buddha nature is inherent within us, and so, you know, we need to relax into that and know that, you know, we don't have to struggle. Jesus knew it too. He said, you know, the kingdom of heaven is being taken by violence, but that's not the way. You know, we don't have to be violent about it. And I think it's sage advice, you know, take it a little easier, not try and force it to happen.
When, you know, as you said, I've been on a number of times and we've revisited this issue virtually every time, but it's very important. Both the point Mark makes is that, you know, to start off with a kind of week-long silent retreat might not be the best idea for a lot of people, or in fact isn't the best idea. Another thing that, in the same way that meditating is difficult, that one of the things that's very noticeable to someone who's trained in Asian religious traditions is with both yoga and mindfulness, and kind of earlier with Tantra, the things that got dropped out very quickly was the ethical behavior that was supposed to be a precursor to mental cultivation. And so that seems to be something Americans are very good at, forgetting that these traditions are based on a pretty, what you might call rigorous, I don't know if you'd want to call the Ten Commandments exactly, thing of proper ethical behavior. And so if I, you know, hit the yoga postures or I sit solo and meditate for a few minutes, I don't really have to worry about what in fact the tradition said they were actually was the basis, the point to start from.
I had a guy last week, very nice.
Well, you just cut out. Okay, so we're on, but he isn't.
Am I back?
There you are. Yes.
I hope you talked amongst yourselves while I was gone.
We said we actually got all your listeners to achieve supreme perfect enlightenment in that minute.
Yeah.
Well, that was my intent because I was practicing nothingless meditation. You know, there was nothing there. Well, good. We have achieved it.
and I was actually looking
go ahead.
I do want to mention a book. This is, we've been talking a lot about millennials, and Mark and I have found a book that is really excellent, College and 20-Year-Olds, a book by a woman named Holly Rogers, The Mindful 20-Something, and it's got an array of exercises, some of which we've talked about here, but it's written in what I find a little irritating sometimes, what you might call millennialese, but it's really user-friendly stuff. So it is, I'll mention contemplativefrogs.com. It's on, again, it's on there, but that's a really useful book. And then I want to make sure we segue at least for a minute to this huge symposium we're having here, where we're bringing an array of people, but I'll let Mark talk more about
that. Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, so Paul, the it's called the MORE Symposium, and the money for the symposium was donated by, I forgot his first name, I think Ronald Moore.
Yeah.
And so he gave some money to endow a symposium every few years. And it's housed in the philosophy department, and there have been a number of these. And one of the members of our contemplative studies steering committee is the organizer of the symposium. His name is Blake Hester. You can find information about him on our Contemplative Frogs website. But he is the organizer of the symposium, but Andy and I have been working with him because the theme or the title of the symposium is posed as a question, and that is, what is well-being? And so Blake and Andy and I and others, there's a number of other people, including two brothers from the Moore family, have been working to organize this, and it will be held in March of next year. And there'll be a variety of speakers. So we'll have people from philosophy, from Buddhist meditation teachers. And then the keynote will be delivered by the figure I mentioned earlier in the show. His name is Richard Davidson. He is the founder and the director of the Center for Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin. And he is internationally famous for the research that he and his colleagues have done trying to understand what happens to, inside in the brain when people engage in meditation, but also what happens with the emotions. There's a very good podcast on the 10% Happier podcast with Richard Davidson and his good friend Daniel Goleman about a book that they recently wrote called Altered Traits. But anyway, Richard Davidson will be coming and will give the keynote for the symposium, which will go on for about 3 days. We're really excited about this.
I really like the idea of looking at what is well-being in this really broad sense, kind of philosophical thinking, therapeutic models, religious traditions. And so we've got, dare I say, a smorgasbord of speakers.
There we go.
You knew he was going to do it again.
Approaching, and we will, people, every day there will be practices as well as theorizing. So anyway, because not everyone is local, we don't need to say that much more about it, but it's really, it's going to take us to sort of a new level.
Yeah,
so we're
that's excellent.
Excited. But we're doing a lot of other things here. Mark and I aren't the only ones who are introducing contemplative exercises in our classes, not only at TCU, but nationally. And what we call it is, we call it the wave. And so we're surfing the contemplative studies waves. We were asked to go up to a nearby university, Austin College, to present to them. Each of us in different ways has been asked to go to churches or other places to talk about it. And I wager you probably have too. So the wave continues here and broader.
Go ahead.
Well, let me just add a few things about the wave. But it's interesting, we, Andy and I, have been working with a lot of different interest groups or stakeholders and at TCU, including nursing, the medical school, the business school, and others, because they recognize that this is an important part of the wave. And so we're hoping to eventually create a minor at TCU where a student could come in and get a minor in, we'd have to think about the name, contemplative practice, or so they would have classes across the curriculum that would teach them how to, you know, to be mindful, to engage in what Andy mentioned before, deep listening, and all of the practices associated with them. So we're really quite excited about that.
You know, we live in a fascinating world, don't we, where we have such mature practices. I'd call it a mature practice because it requires a certain maturity of mind, a healthy mindedness, in the midst of all the craziness that you referenced earlier, the divisiveness. And maybe they nest together. You know, maybe when times are crazy. No doubt in Jesus's time, you know, the Romans were slaughtering people left, right, and center, and yet out of that came these beautiful teachings, and the so such is the world, I guess. But I take great comfort, and what I take great comfort in even more is the enthusiasm by which you present this, which tells me there's something to it, right? Because if we're excited about it, we know that it's efficacious, it's useful, and we want to share it. So thanks for bringing that kind of energy to the show. Let me tell you about next week's show, and then we'll say goodbye to Andy and Mark. Next week, I begin a two-part series discussing unity and the interfaith movement. It's in preparation for a workshop and service to be held at the upcoming Unity Convention in Kansas City in June. And members of Unity's Multicultural and Interfaith Task Team, of which I'm a member, join me. Next week, I'll be with Unity Ministers Victoria Echemendi and Ariana Platten. We're going to discuss how does Unity and Interfaith fit together. And then the following week, we'll have more insight into the compassionate component of interfaith. So I think that should be an interesting series of shows. And right now, I want to say thank you so much to Andy and to Mark for being on today's show and exciting us. I'm going straight to that contemplative practices website. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
All right, bye-bye now.
Thank you for listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.